From Tennessee to Washington, Hawaii to Ohio, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Biden administration is proposing new emission rules that would force most of the nation's coal and natural gas-fired power plants to close. Darren Fast of the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here to discuss the impact. Negotiations are underway in Washington, D.C., aimed at raising the federal debt ceiling and potentially curbing the growth of spending. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Unexpected emergencies from pandemics to natural disasters are certain to occur. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jonathan Bidlack of the R Street Institute about why we should prepare now. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is running for President of the United States. He could have a profound impact on the 2024 race. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Once again, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency is waging war against fossil fuel electric power generation, and the impact on the supply grid could be devastating. Darren Bask is Deputy Director of the Competitive Institute Center for Energy and Environment. He's here to discuss the proposed regulations. Darren, welcome to American Radio Journal. Darren, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, once again attempting to propagate new rules that would have a dramatic impact on certain power plants across the country. Can you fill us in on what the EPA is proposing?
They're proposing regulations that will, in effect, force natural gas and coal power plants to allow them to go out of business or to impose such significant costs that it will drive up prices. And this is really important because 60% of our electricity comes from natural gas and coal plants. And as a result, we're just going to wind up with less of this reliable electricity generation. And unfortunately, we're going to have less reliable electricity generation as a result. The EPA is trying to kind of use its power to become, in effect, the energy czar of the country, and there's simply no authority for them to do that.
They've tried this before, haven't they, and it didn't work out too well?
They did. They had a rule called the Clean Power Plan, and the Supreme Court shut down that rule a couple years ago. This is a different way of approaching really the issue, but ultimately they're doing the same thing, which is trying to change the way that electricity is generated in this country. It might look different, but the approach is, and the intent is still the same. There's a recognition by the agency that, in fact, their actions will, because of the demands placed on these power plants, in effect, shut down coal plants and likely even natural gas plants as well. So, again, the effect will be the same. It's one thing to regulate a business and to allow them to kind of be in operation. But what the EPA is doing is they're saying, all right, we're going to regulate emissions. And, hey, one way to regulate emissions is we'll make sure that you don't exist anymore. Well, I guess that is a way to make sure you have lower emissions, but that's not what regulation means. That's, to me, not regulating something that's actually banning something.
Given the progress that has been made in cutting back on the carbon emissions that come out of these power plants over recent years, recent decades here, Darren, why the push to enact such stringent regulations with the obvious goal of simply putting them out of business?
That's a great question, something we've certainly, a lot of us have been talking about, you know, that these plants have already made significant progress when it comes to emissions reduction. In many ways, you could argue unnecessary. There's constant improvement on the emissions side. So it does beg that question. Maybe the effort is they just want everything to be renewable energy sources. The problem with that is you wind up with a scenario where we're going to have grid reliability problems. You can't have reliable electricity, be able to flick on the switch and ensure that you're going to have the light turn on just through solar and wind. You have to have what's called baseload generation, which is kind of reliable sources that are always, for the most part, always running, like natural gas plants and coal plants. And the Biden administration is just trying to get rid of those sources and try to make everything renewable. But the problem is renewable is intermittent. You know, the sun doesn't always shine, wind doesn't always blow. And as a result, you really need to depend on these, the natural gas plants and coal plants. So yes, it seems unnecessary, costly, and I think a huge risk and threat to the grid and also just Americans just living their lives because we rely on energy.
So what do we replace these power sources with here? As you pointed out, solar and wind is undependable and it can't generate enough to replace the power generated by carbon fuels. Is there any loosening of regulations or effort to allow other sources such as, for example, nuclear power, or are there still stringent regulations on that industry as well?
Stringent regulations on nuclear as well, and it's very difficult to get a plant built for nuclear. It appears on the surface the administration simply thinks you can just have a grid with renewable energy, and what you do is you wind up having what are called these backup generating plants, like natural gas plants, that they're like peaker. They're called peaker plants. So in other words, they kick on when there's a peak demand, there's more demand for electricity. So they just have all this backup generation because you have to have the backup generation because, again, wind and solar are not going to be generating electricity all the time. And then you just have all this backup generation. But that's not going to provide the necessary electricity that's needed. You have to have this baseload generation. Maybe in the future, down the line, there'll be different sources that can change the mix, but we should allow that to kind of happen through the market. And as opposed to trying to dictate what energy is going to be used, but worse, what the administration is doing is not picking the most reliable and efficient energy sources, electricity sources, it's picking the most costly and unreliable energy sources. And it's worth pointing out that they're doing this simultaneously at the same time that they're trying to push electrification of everything. You know, they're trying to electrify the fleet, you know, for cars. They're trying to put even more pressure on the grid. So you've got two bad ideas happening at one time, and it's going to hurt American families and especially hurt low-income families who are going to wind up paying more, have a disproportionate impact as a result of these higher energy prices.
I was going to say here, Darren, if you look at last summer, we already had some rolling blackouts in California. We've had power issues in Texas because of not enough power available on the grid. They're also, as you've just pointed out, they're trying to push for a more rapid changeover to electric vehicles. So you're adding a whole new demand on the energy grid. So more electric utilizing vehicles, less power plants. Hasn't anybody sat back and thought we're headed for a major problem here?
Certainly some of us are, and a lot of people are, but it doesn't seem to matter. It's unfortunate that people should not simply just buy into this electrification of everything, the electrification of the cars. So people should know that the administration's literally going to make it more difficult for you to buy the cars that we all know and love. There are things regarding like gas stoves, for example. They don't want you to use natural gas in buildings. They want you to use electric stoves. I mean, just everything is about electric. And at the same time, it's so they're trying to tell you kind of how to live your life. And then they're trying to use this electricity mix that's going to not be suitable to even meet that kind of central planning scheme that they have to electrify everything. So it's important for people and listeners to push back against this. Don't accept it.
We have been talking with Darren Basks, who is Deputy Director of the Competitive Enterprise Institute Center for Energy and Environment. Darren, tell us just a little bit about CEI. Also, where can folks go on the web if they want to read your research and your writings on this topic?
For the website, it's CEI.org. So it's Competitive Enterprise Institute's website. And CEI is a organization that believes in kind of free markets, limited government. We really focus on trying to reduce the regulatory burden that's being imposed on Americans and the expansive scope of the administrative state. So if you kind of believe in freedom and individual liberty, please visit us at CEI.org.
Darren Basks from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Darren, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We have a lot of activity both in Washington, D.C., also out on the campaign trail. We're going to cover both of those areas with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
The debt ceiling is the big topic of discussion, Scott, in Washington, D.C. Some claim it's a crisis. Some say not so much. What is the status of the negotiations?
This week, President Biden and the congressional leadership once again gathered at the White House. And finally, after several months, they have agreed to sort of whittle down how many people are in the room negotiating, and President Biden will be directly negotiating with Kevin McCarthy and his designees. We understand that there have been some senior staffers, along with a congressman from Louisiana named Garrett Graves, that are leading those House negotiations. Obviously, Joe Biden doesn't want to be in the room negotiating any legislation, right? He wants his aides and trusted advisors to essentially tell him this is what can pass the House and it's acceptable to us. So Biden's not going to be in the negotiating room like he was in 2011 with John Boehner during the Obama debt limit negotiation with the budget deal. This is a far different situation, even though politically the majorities in Congress are fairly similar when it comes to a House majority, but Senate Democrats holding the ball with cloture and the legislative filibuster. So what I'm kind of seeing right now is a real negotiation that's finally kicking off. We've been so-called issued warnings from the Treasury Secretary that there is an economic crisis ahead and that we're going to hit that X date in early June. Congress is scheduled to be in recess next week for Memorial Day. There's a good chance that they may be called back in order to pass legislation prior to June 1. But I think what the listeners need to really understand is this isn't going to be a default on our debt obligations. There's plenty of revenue for a short-term period, pay our bills when it comes to the net interest payments, when it comes to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, veteran benefits. It's just going to be things that might see a lapse in funding for a couple of weeks that folks wouldn't really notice in the day-to-day operation of their lives and the kitchen table conversations. How do the markets react? I think the markets want to see a deal that ends trillion-dollar deficits and this unsustainable crisis that we have with inflation and with excessive spending. And the Federal Reserve has tried to do that with 10 interest rate increases over just the last year and a half or so. But there's more work to be done. We obviously need to see the details of what a debt limit negotiation that can get Democrats in the Senate and enough Republicans in the House move forward, because we know Republicans in the Senate have said they will not support a clean debt limit increase. But I do think that there's some folks that are starting to feel those nerves. And we need to build our backbone. We need to have a little bit of titanium and steel and grow the spine necessary to save the American economy and ensure that we're not in this exact same situation in just about a year or a year and a half.
Are we not actually in this situation where our backs are sort of against the wall here somewhat, Scott, because of the demand by the president and Senate Democrats that there be a clean bill? Wasn't it unrealistic to suggest that they could even get that and not do any negotiation at all?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that the Democrats' position is unsustainable. Club for Growth issued some polling a few weeks ago that showed only 29% of the American people think that Biden should not negotiate on the debt limit. I think most folks understand that we have a power-sharing agreement with a House Republican majority, a Senate Democrat majority, and Democrats controlling the White House. But that doesn't mean that they get to just pick up their ball and go home. It means that they need to come to the table and play this game, even if it's a little ugly in how the sausage is made in Washington.
Let's shift gears here and go out on the campaign trail. We don't have any new announcements relative to the Republican presidential nomination for 2024, but we're getting signals from a couple of folks that announcements may be imminent. What are we seeing developing out there on the trail?
Well, we're at the point in the year. This is the middle of May in 2023. There's a lot of time to go for folks to make the decision on whether to get in the race or not. But obviously, there's been wide reports that my former boss, Ron DeSantis, is taking a look at it. Tim Scott earlier issued a exploratory committee, and he looks like he's going to formally jump in the race. We know that in August we'll have the first debate. Even if President Trump doesn't want to participate, I think that there will be other folks that do want to get their message out to the American people and sort of build out their own brand to see if they've got a chance to sneak in there. and build support. It's a point in the cycle where I think folks need to start raising money to be competitive with the early states in 2024. But there's still several months to go. I think it's a political lifetime in terms of the jockeying that's going to happen. But it's an exciting time for sure. Obviously, President Trump has already announced. Nikki Haley has announced. Vivek Ramaswamy has announced. There's other folks that have announced they're not running, like Mike Pompeo. Then you've got folks that are still being speculated about when it comes to Vice President Mike Pence. And I think there should also be a lot of attention on what Joe Biden is doing, because he obviously announced his hard reelection a couple weeks ago. I think it barely got any coverage, to be honest, but it was sort of a box checker. And we'll be watching closely to see how there are more developments in the coming weeks and months.
I find it interesting relative to Joe Biden and his announcement, Scott, that also we have Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has entered the race. He seems to be polling at somewhere in the high teens or 20%. Is it possible that he might actually make that race at least somewhat interesting?
Well, we'll see. I think that it just demonstrates that there's a call for a different type of a candidate within the left.
Well, the trail has a long way to go. We don't have the first actual votes cast until January, so we will continue to keep an eye on the presidential race developing. Also, we're going to, from time to time, check in with Scott Parkinson on races for U.S. Senate and Congress around the country. They're all up in 2024 as well. But for right now, Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 500,000 supporters and members. If you just want to sign up and join for free, you can do so. clubforgrowth.org. And follow us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you very much. Talk to you next week.
Okay, thank you.
From pandemics to natural disasters, emergency situations have bloated the federal deficit. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jonathan Bidlack of the R Street Institute about preparing in advance for such emergencies.
The national debt has exploded in recent years, and one of the big drivers of that are, of course, the entitlement program, Social Security, Medicare. We talk about that stuff on this program quite often. One thing we don't talk about very often here, and almost never anywhere else in society or in politics, is the impact of emergency spending, off-budget spending, on the national debt and on the amount of money that the government spends every year. That runs the gamut, everything from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to the COVID-19 pandemic. But the fact that we don't have much of a conversation about what actually constitutes a national emergency makes it really hard to put some constraints around how much money we'll spend during one of those national emergencies. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Jonathan Bidlack. He's the director of the governance program at the R Street Institute and a friend of the show. He joins us again now to talk about his latest policy paper, The Known Unknowns, Planning for the Next Emergencies. You can find that now at rstreet.org. Jonathan, thanks for taking some time with us here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is really a fantastic paper. I encourage people to go check it out. We're not going to have time to get through all the details of it here, but one of the things that you talk about in this piece that I think is really essential is about defining an emergency. The way I kind of think about this thing is like when the levees broke in New Orleans, that was an emergency, but rebuilding the city after Katrina, that's not an emergency anymore. But that's not the way policymakers look at it too often.
No, they don't. And that's a great analogy. I mean, the point of an emergency is supposed to be that it's kind of a sudden, unforeseen, you know, urgent kind of scenario. And I've made the analogy in the past of, I think it's sort of like a car accident, right? Is the quintessential example of an emergency where we recognize that the situation is really serious. We give special powers to ambulances, for example, to go through red lights or do that sort of thing. But months later, when that person's recovering and they're going for physical therapy, we don't say, well, you get to do the same thing as ambulances do and, you know, go through red lights on your way to physical therapy. And so I think that sometimes people conflate the initial crisis, the initial instigating event, with this broader question and say, well, just because something important is still going on, it must still be an emergency. And that's not necessarily the case.
I think you one-upped me there with the analogy. That is spectacular. I love that one. I'm going to use that again. But one of the things, there was some discussion about this, particularly in state capitals. There was even some action on this in some states during COVID, where state legislatures kind of reined in some of those emergency powers that governors had seized and that they continued to use 18 months or 2 years after the initial crisis had passed. So we'll talk about the spending side of it too, but talk to me a little bit about the emergency powers aspect here, because that's kind of important. When do we let government be the ambulance that goes through traffic and gets to blow through red lights?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And, you know, as I argue in the paper, I don't think that people always make that connection between the emergency power side of things and all of the emergency spending. And these are really flip sides of the same coin, where we're basically using these kind of these emergency scenarios to not just spend a whole lot, but sometimes also to go and bestow powers on the executive branch, whether that's at the state level, as you just mentioned, or at the federal level, to sort of do things that they otherwise might not be able to do. And I think that that's something that we should be very concerned about as well. We have checks and balances, right? We have this sort of system that's been set up for hundreds of years for a reason, to sort of provide that kind of check on power. And to the degree that we allow these emergencies to just sort of go on, in the case of COVID, for over 3 years, that creates a whole host of other problems beyond just the spending that is associated with that emergency.
We're talking with Jonathan Bidlack. He's the director of the governance program at the R Street Institute, talking about emergency powers and the emergency spending that often comes with those powers. When do we let government just go off the budget, go off the rails, spend whatever is necessary to combat an emergency? The spending is really just one part of a broader problem, because we've kind of had this like ongoing sort of the sense that we're just kind of always going from emergency to emergency to emergency, really since, I guess you could date it back to 9/11, since then, that there's just sort of been a shift in the way government maybe thinks about its role relative to these constraints that have historically been in place. We think about COVID maybe as being different from some of those other emergencies because it was a health emergency as opposed to terrorism or a natural disaster, but really like sort of the same factors at play in a lot of these. Not a lot of time left here, Jonathan, but I do want to give you a chance to propose like a couple solutions for us, because in many cases, like the solution is already there, right? We've got the rules in place. It's just a matter of like forcing government to actually follow them.
That's right. And I think there are a number of things here. There's not necessarily a silver bullet, but we need to tighten up what constitutes an emergency, maybe limit how long they last to start with, maybe put some restraints on executive power in these instances. And then there's a whole host of, I think, budgetary reforms and even private sector things that can be done. You know, we have insurance markets for a reason, right? There are private sector solutions to these problems as well that could maybe lessen the need to be reliant on the federal government when these types of situations arise. So I think there are a lot of things that we should be looking at.
Yeah, and one of the things you say in the piece, we'll finish with this, is that encouraging better emergency planning, like there's always going to be another crisis, yet the government doesn't seem to ever prepare for it in advance. That's something else that you can be socking aside some money preparing for the next crisis so it doesn't catch you off guard. And of course, if we had a balanced budget, that would make it a lot easier too. We could go on and on. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today, so we've got to let him go. But that is Jonathan Bidlack from the R Street Institute. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again. Appreciate it.
And again, Jonathan Bidlack is the director of the governance program at the R Street Institute. Check out his latest work at rstreet.org. The name of this piece, The Known Unknowns, Planning for the Next Emergencies. Governments should do a better job of that than they're doing right now. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out everything we're working on this week at reason.com and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is running for president, and although he is not likely to win, he could have a significant impact on the outcome of the 2024 race. So says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this American Radio Journal commentary.
I'm considering voting for RFK Jr. He's a very interesting alternative to both parties. So writes Henry, a reader of one of my columns. In fact, what's interesting about Henry is that the presidential candidacy of Democrat Robert F. Kennedy Jr. appeals to him not as a Joe Biden voter, but as a Donald Trump voter. Like millions who voted for Donald Trump or for Joe Biden, Henry has never been happy about his choice. He prefers someone else. Ironically, Henry was responding to an article that I did in RFK Jr. for the American Spectator, of which I'm the editor. The article was titled, Doomsday for Democrats, How RFK Jr. Could Elect Trump. Check it out. In fact, my piece made precisely that point, namely that RFK Jr.'s candidacy could elect Donald Trump by pulling votes from Joe Biden, especially if RFK Jr., who's a Democrat, ultimately goes third party. In response to that article, I got a bunch of media requests and a lot of reactions, but what I didn't expect were reactions like Henry's. Yes, an RFK Jr. third-party run would take votes away from his fellow Democrat, Joe Biden, but they might also take votes away from Donald Trump. That is, if Trump becomes a Republican nominee. The son of Bobby Kennedy is apparently an option for people in both parties. Interesting, isn't it? RFK Jr.'s appeal to such voters is his staunch independence. Unlike seemingly every Kennedy kid, he's not a politician, though he has spent much of his life in public service. For decades, RFK Jr. has been a public health advocate. Most recently, he was a leader against vax mandates, especially for children and young people not at high risk of death from COVID. And for this sin, a nasty little box now pops up when you Google RFK Jr.'s name. It says, quote, Robert Francis Kennedy Jr. is an American environmental lawyer and author known for promoting anti-vaccine propaganda and health-related conspiracy theories, unquote. Well, that kind of smear is typical of the web, and people everywhere, frankly, are sick of it. Some anonymous millennial working for Google or Twitter or Facebook slimes you as a conspiracy theorist, peddling misinformation. You don't even know who to protest to or what your misinformation is. You can't even fight back. You're just smeared. Well, RFK Jr. is fighting back. His response to being labeled a propagandist and conspiracy theorist is to walk bravely into the public square and speak even louder. He has declared his candidacy for the presidency of the United States. Now, this isn't to say that I personally would vote for RFK Jr., but clearly many would. In fact, he's polling at roughly 20% among Democrats. If he went third party, he could pull more support still from independents and even some Republicans. Now, would that serve to elect him president? No. But here's what it could do. It could toss the 2024 race into chaos. And yes, it could elect Donald Trump, who I believe can't get 50% of the overall popular vote. Trump's ceiling is probably about 46%. And yet, and here's the key, though Donald Trump can't win the presidency in a two-man race, he could win it in a three-man race with RFK Jr. entering the fray. Think, in 1992, Democrat Bill Clinton won with only 43% of the vote because third-party candidate Ross Perot played spoiler. He got 19%, which foiled Republican George H.W. Bush's attempted re-election. In 1968, Republican Richard Nixon was elected with only 43% against Democrat Hubert Humphrey, with third-party independent George Wallace pulling votes. Likewise, in 1912, Democrat Woodrow Wilson secured the presidency with only 42% in basically a three-man race that Teddy Roosevelt jumped into. So, could RFK Jr.'s entry have this same effect in 2024? Well, we shall see. The 2024 presidential race could be in for some big surprises. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WCTS-AM in Plymouth, Minnesota, KTSC-FM in Pueblo, Colorado, along with Utah Community Radio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.